It's been some time since we were last in the book of Daniel. Would you please locate that book? Daniel is roughly in the middle of the Christian Bible, in the Old Testament. With Easter being early this year, we probably won't finish Daniel by Easter comes, but we have some time to settle back in before Easter arrives. If you've not been with us, or you're not familiar maybe with the Christian Bible, and especially this book of Daniel, then let me just take about 5 minutes to review what's going on in this book of Daniel. The name of the book, Daniel, is the name of the main human character. He begins his life living in Israel, yet in the middle of his teenage years, he witnesses the death of several family and friends, and he witnesses the destruction of his homeland. Ancient Israel, where he grew up, is given into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Daniel then is deported along with other nobles and upper class and artisans. He's deported across the Fertile Crescent as a teenager, now as a prisoner of war, where he will endure a forced re-education and acculturation process. They want Daniel now to forget his ethnic heritage, and they want him to forget his religion and forget everything about his God. Daniel is to become now a poster child of Babylonian ethics and Babylonian values. He's to become a poster child for everything good about Babylon. So how do you live in that environment, especially when you're a teenager? How do you live when your ethnicity and your religion are no longer enjoying a privileged status, but now they're despised? To put it in a more modern way, what place does religion, what place does the God of the Bible have in a secular world? These are all very live questions for us today. And Daniel, along with other historical figures like Joseph and Esther, these three figures in the Christian Bible show us, are some of the most important characters in the Bible that show us how we should live in a hostile world. So beginning in Daniel 1 and running through the rest of this book, there is this tension that we all experience. Don't withdraw and don't assimilate. And Daniel's life and his actions, as well as the three friends that we're introduced to, they show us that you can't withdraw from the world, not even a hostile world. That's not an option. We've seen that Daniel has worked for some of the most powerful political empires in world history. And Daniel never withdrew from any of those situations, you know, as kind of a conscientious objector. He served those political kings and those empires, and he served them well. You can't withdraw, even from a hostile world. And on the other hand, so on one hand, he doesn't withdraw, but on the other hand, Daniel doesn't assimilate. It's clear. Everybody knows. Daniel's a servant of the Most High God. He doesn't defile himself with the king's diet, his food. Now, all of us fall off the rails somewhere. That's the tension of living in the world. We either drift, usually we either drift towards withdrawal, or we drift towards assimilation. And both of them we call holy and righteous. But which do you struggle with? Daniel knew he had to draw lines. He had to maintain his trust in the Most High God. He must never blush to speak his name. He must not withdraw, but he must not assimilate either. So as a result, Daniel and his friends sometimes found themselves in positions of great favor, second, third in command under Babylon and leaders that follow like Belshazzar. And sometimes they found themselves in the fiery furnace and in a den of lions for the crime of believing in God and praying regularly 3 times a day. As Christians, they experience the blessing of not withdrawing, and they experienced the intolerance of tolerance living as Christians in Babylon. All of that plays out in Daniel 1-6. with this particular emphasis struck and repeated. By and large, the first six chapters, we have a God. This is what happens again and again. Daniel 1-6. We have a God who sovereignly delivers his people from hostile governments and people again and again and again. And Daniel showing us, God showing us, God's power is not diminished because somebody who doesn't believe in him is in charge. God's power is more on display, you know, when religion is not in a privileged status, when people don't believe in him. The gospel advances again and again and again. He delivers again and again and again. God rules and he rescues his people. His power is never limited. These first six chapters also show us that God also humbles those who oppose him whenever he wants to. Chapters 3 to 6, then, are stories of God's miraculous deliverance. But chapters 4 and 5 in the middle are stories of God humbling two powerful, arrogant kings, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. So the message is really clear. The God who humbled the most powerful kings can humble you whenever he wants to. And the God who delivered his faithful servants can deliver you. Our God is mighty to save. He's strong in salvation. And as Nebuchadnezzar learned, these are his words, nobody can stop his hand or say to him, "What are you doing?" Daniel shows us the God who rules and the God who saves. Yet when we come to Daniel 7, which is where we are today, the emphasis changes a little bit. God is just as sovereign over the successes of his people, Daniel 1-6, as he is over their suffering, Daniel 7 and the rest of the book. The book of Daniel shows us that God is mighty to deliver, to save his people. And the book of Daniel also shows us that God doesn't always deliver his people. There are shady green pastures and still waters as we follow God in this life. There is a table for us in the presence of our enemies. There are also valleys of deep darkness. There are also valleys of the shadow of death. Both of these experiences are normal Christian experience. Expect the valleys of deep darkness as much as you expect the green pastures. That's just normal. That's just what it's like to follow Jesus. And if it troubles us, just think for a moment of our Lord Jesus Christ. If God didn't deliver Jesus from his moment of suffering, then don't be surprised if God doesn't deliver you from your moment of suffering either. Brothers and sisters, we follow a crucified Messiah, risen to be sure, but the crucifixion precedes the resurrection. Jesus told us the servant is not above his master. He warned us so that we would not be disillusioned. If they hate me as your master without a cause, they will hate you, but love your enemies. But no, they will hate you. Daniel 1-6 shows us the triumphs of the fiery furnace. It shows us the triumphs of the lion's den. But Daniel 7-12 shows us the severe suffering of his saints, ordained. God is sovereign to deliver, and he will ultimately deliver. And Daniel 7 also shows us that God is also sovereign over the death of his people. God is sovereign over suffering. That's what we have in Daniel 7 and 8. The rest of the book. We come to Daniel 7, we have a frightening picture. A frightening picture of what we can expect as we live life in Babylon. Daniel himself is deeply troubled by what God reveals to him in this dream. And yet all of this is recorded, brothers and sisters, all of this is recorded so that we're not surprised. So that it's like somebody who sets out, you know, to head to the New England area on a road trip, and they're 6 hours ahead of you, and they tell you, we passed through lots of stormy weather and couldn't see and blinding rain, and you'll probably go through it too, so that when you hit it, you don't think, I missed the turn. That's what God's doing in Daniel 7, so that we would have comfort and courage, so that when pain and suffering come our way, we won't think it's strange. And we will hear Jesus say to us, in this world, you will have tribulation. But take heart. I have overcome the world. That's the message of Daniel 7. Now, hopefully you'll get that, even if your brain checks out the rest of the message this morning. Let's think now specifically about chapter 7. Daniel and the kings he served often had dreams, bad dreams, like you and I do. But these were really bad dreams. And just like our own dreams are often symbolic and fantastical, I had a dream this week I tried to explain to my wife, and she said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I said, I really don't either, but it was scary when I was in it. That's what's happening to Daniel here. Things that don't make sense on one level, they don't follow together. It's like he wakes up in a haunted house. But when he wakes up, he's told it's not a dream. It's really going to happen. And that makes it worse. It involves four frightful, beastly figures coming out of the depths of the sea that's churning and is stirred up by the winds blowing. It'd be a great scene to kind of capture in some kind of art medium. Here is Daniel blanketed by nightfall. He's standing on a cragged coast of steep and massive rocks with sea foam splashing around his feet in the rocks and sea spray in his face, and he squints his eyes, and what he sees turns his face white with fear. We're told several times he's terrified, he's alarmed, he's distressed. Well, let's read what Daniel sees. Daniel 7, verses 1 to 8, this is what Holy Scripture says. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream, visions in his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, and he told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. And then as I looked, its wings were plucked off. It was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And a mind of man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, kind of like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth, between its teeth. And it was told, arise, devour much flesh. And after this I looked, and behold another, like a leopard, with 4 wings of a bird on its back, and the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. And after this I saw in the night visions, and behold a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the other beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, an 11th horn, a little one, before which 3 of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. This is the word of the Lord. Now, if you're asking, what in the world does all this mean? Those are the same questions that Daniel asks. I guess it's kind of like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea meets Moby Dick, meets The Perfect Storm, meets Jurassic Park, and Daniel's saying, what is going on? So he asks, look at verse 15. That's what he actually asks. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions in my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all of this. And he tells him the interpretation. And Daniel not only asks, what do these beasts mean? But he especially wants to know about this fourth beast who's more terrible and more dreadful than all of the others. I mean, this one has more horns than Triceratops, and then after the 10 horns, a little horn rises up and it's greater than all of the others. You know, ever since Daniel asked, what do these four beasts mean, and what are the 10 horns, and what are the little horns, people have asked those ever since. Some people are more sure of the details than others. I think we can be more certain of some of the details than Daniel is, but there will come a point as we look at this chapter that we will be in the same position. Daniel doesn't know a thing that's going on other than what he sees, and impressions left on him, the same that's left on us. So when we get to the end of Daniel 7, we're going to be in the same point, and we'll go, I have no idea. But the major lessons and themes will hit us just like they hit Daniel. Well, Daniel's told. Now let's start to think about this. Daniel's told in verse 17 and 18 a basic summary of what he sees. So if you want to know, we know at least this much. Look at verses 17 and 18. These four great beasts, they are four great kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever. So that's the summary. It looks bad, but it ends well. Well, how do we get there? Before we look at that, I think that what this tells us, these two verses tell us, is that while the details of this dream are highly symbolic, just like dreams often are, they're nevertheless historical. Indeed, the whole chapter opens with a historical marker in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. Daniel 5, we looked at that before, tells us about Belshazzar's last night on earth. He's a real person. He really died. But long before that, during this year of his rule, Daniel has a dream. The point is that both the time of his dream during his reign and the meaning of the dream, four kings, points to historical realities. Highly symbolic to be sure, figurative to be sure, we don't know all the details to be sure, but it points to historical realities that will transpire in real history. And what Daniel sees, here's the summary, what Daniel sees is nothing less than human history stretching out before him from his own day to the second coming of Christ. Daniel sees three kingdoms arising from the earth, all in succession. The fourth arises, out of which will arise kingdoms and a final kingdom that takes us all the way to the Son of Man coming with clouds. And what's remarkable is that Daniel has this dream of kingdoms yet to come while Babylon is still the superpower of the day. While Belshazzar and Babylon boast of their superpower status, God gives Daniel a dream that shows there are three more, a fifth even coming way after you. Thus, in the vision, we see what Daniel was to see too, that God is sovereign over all points of history. He's sovereign over the nations of the world, even the yet to come. Indeed, God is the one who calls nations into existence and even grants them power. Daniel at least is to see that, and all of those living with him in his day. And here's how the account opens. The account opens almost, it's almost a recreation of Genesis. Genesis opens and the Spirit of God hovers over the water. And when this dream opens, It's the Spirit of God. It's the four winds of heaven stirring up the sea again. And who's behind the emergence of these four beasts and the kingdoms they represent? Who's behind it all? Who's stirring it all up? It's God Himself. God is sovereign over nations and rulers, even the ones yet to come and even rulers yet to be elected. God is putting His person in place every time. And the historical details in Daniel 7 are so remarkable that critics of the Bible will say there is no... These details are so exact on their major details, no one could have written them beforehand. Somebody had to come in after the fact and write them back into the story. Or, some people will say, these are so symbolic that we only know general themes. Now that's true, we know the general themes. On the one hand, you see there's an error of reading everything in this chapter to match up, you know, with every horn and every toe and every point of it, you know, precise details, that it's like, why was this confusing to Daniel anyway? It all makes so much sense to us. That's the detail that most of us grew up with, and I think as a result, some of us then are afraid to say this actually has historical reference. We need to be careful of either error of saying it's so symbolic, or certainly shying away totally from saying that, you know, this is so exact it can't be true history. But Daniel is told these events, and he's told these four beasts picture four kingdoms that will come from the earth. And not only this, but as we saw a few weeks ago, in the middle of this passage is the Son of Man. And Jesus sees Himself as the Son of Man, a literal historical fulfillment of all that's going on here. Now, all of this then points to symbolic nature of what's going on, and it also points to real history. And why do we stress that as we look at Daniel 7? We do it, first of all, to stress the reliability of the Bible. Daniel 7 is predictive prophecy, and it comes true. And we need to be reminded, you can trust the Bible. Every word of the Lord proves true. We also do it to stress the sovereignty of God over world affairs. What we will soon see is that God not only grants good nations their power, God grants evil nations and rulers their power. We also do this to stress that if God is sovereign over the details of the future, if God is sovereign over world affairs, then God is sovereign over our lives too. He knew right where Daniel was. He knew right where His people were. And brothers and sisters, He knows right where you are in your life. Even behind the most fearful events lies the activity of God. You could write that over Daniel 7. Even behind the most fearful events lies the activity of God. Now, you may have forgotten that Daniel 2 to 7 are part of a large unit. And this will help us as we start to look at the details of Daniel 7. Chapters 2 to 7 are all written in an international language of business and debate of that day. A challenge is being issued with these chapters. A massive piece for debate is being issued to the world in Daniel 2 to 7. They're also arranged in a big ring cycle. So you start in the middle, and chapters 4 and 5 are about two kings that are humbled. Chapters 3 and 6 are both about stories of deliverance. Chapters 2 and 7, the outer layer of this ring, of this tract to the world, are both accounts of future historical kingdoms. One looks like a giant statue, and one looks like a giant four beasts. Both of them are communicating the same thing. God is sovereign over world history. Well, chapter 7 then parallels chapter 2. And given the structure of chapters 2 to 7 and the arrangement of 4 and 5 and 3 and 6, then 2 and 7 are parallel, which probably is a good indication that the details in chapter 2 are the same details in chapter 7. Well, why in chapter 2 are the nations of the world presented like a colossal statue of different gold, and in this chapter they're presented as a beast? Well, I think one thing that the emphasis that we get now in Daniel 7 is this is what a grasp for power looks like without God in the picture. Man becomes less than man. Man becomes unman. He becomes a beast. People without God don't become more human. They become beasts. And even distortions of beasts. And God is showing us the nature of evil. It's a distortion of good. So let's think about this, starting at the beginning. Again, Daniel saw big pictures and big themes that we've pointed out already. But this stage in history, we know a little more than Daniel. And here is what I think that we can know. If and since Daniel 7 and Daniel 2 parallel each other, the statue in Daniel 2 starts with a head of gold, and we're told that head of gold is Nebuchadnezzar. That means that this first beast coming up out of the sea then represents the Babylonian Empire. And look at the description again. The first is like a lion with eagle's wings, verse 4. A lion has always been a frightening symbol of strength and roaring, prowling ferocity. And if you add now the symbol, remember it's a dream, it's like a lion. If you add the symbol of an eagle's wings to a lion, now you add the image of swiftness and speed to this lion. And more than just that general referent of what a lion symbolizes and what wings could, added to that, Jeremiah the prophet actually uses the image of a lion and an eagle to actually refer to Nebuchadnezzar in Jeremiah 48 and 49. We even know from history and archaeology, the beautiful Ishtar Gate in Babylon, that the city walls were embossed with prowling lions. That was what Nebuchadnezzar saw himself as. I remember being in a World History Museum in Berlin several years ago, and they recreated the Ishtar Gate and a part of the entire city wall that felt like you were walking into Babylon. And what was there? These golden lions embossed on a beautiful blue bricked outside wall. This is him. This is how he saw himself. So here is Babylon, ruling and prowling the world stage with the strength of a lion and the swiftness of an eagle. That much Daniel could have guessed himself. The next beast he sees is in verse 5, one like a bear on one side with ribs in its mouth. Well, a bear is no less terrifying than a lion, and I don't know the top rate speed and poundage of the Syrian bear, but I don't think any of us would be in a position to find out what those things are. And he's evidently fresh off of a kill. He has 3 ribs in his mouth, and he's hungry for more. He's raised up on one side, ready to launch out again, and he hears this command, arise and eat much flesh, an insatiable appetite for death and destruction. It's a gruesome scene. And if the parallels with chapter 2 are maintained, then this kingdom represents the Medo-Persian Empire, which in history rises up and conquers Babylon and Belshazzar. The Medes formerly had an alliance with Babylon, but then joined first forces with Persia when the balance of political power shifts. So these two nations form one political alliance, the Medes and the Persians. And you're familiar with their rule in the story of the Bible. The great King Cyrus comes from this empire. Queen Esther lives during the reign of this empire. Ezra and Nehemiah affected by this second great empire. And all of it predicted by God. Now maybe Daniel could have foreseen that. A little prognosticating. But there's no way he could see fully what would come next, or even before we get to next. I want us to think how spectacular the Bible's prediction even of the Mede-Persian Empire is. Because Daniel's not the only one who foresees the Medo-Persian Empire. 200 years before, Isaiah predicted God would raise up a Messiah and writes his name, Cyrus. Before Babylon rose to power, before Cyrus was born or his name was being thought about as a name, you know, by his parents as a name for their child, 200 years before, Isaiah 13, God would stir up the Medes. Who is that? And that Babylon would be overthrown. God is sovereign over the nations and powers. If the image of Babylon and the powerful lion, we see a God sovereign over powerful nations, and the image of this Medo-Persian Empire with this greedy, insatiable bear who wants more and more, we see God as sovereign over all those greedy, expansionistic nations of the world. And then comes the third beast. The third beast is like a leopard. Not just two wings, but four wings. And not just one head or two heads, but four heads. And now dominion is given to it. Well, a leopard is a well-known predator, renowned for stealth and speed and unexpected attacks. And if two wings symbolize swiftness of speed and flight and the ability to descend unexpected attacks, now you have four wings, and what you have is an unnatural, unsurpassed swiftness and an ability to move. But this is why he says this is like a leopard. Because this is a four-headed leopard. Which probably means its four heads are looking in every direction. Or maybe they symbolize, as a head can symbolize, a head of power. Well, regardless of the exact symbolism, here's a leopard-like animal who seems to be able to roam anywhere and to attack with devastating, lightning-fast speed. And to all this, we're told dominion was given to it. It's not to say dominion wasn't given to the other beasts, but this appears to have special dominion given to it, symbolized by the four ruling heads, the four wings, and the strength of speed. A special kind of dominion was given to this one. What is the empire in history that rises up after the Medo-Persian Empire? You'll probably find no better description, even by secular historians looking at this text, saying Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire did act with the swiftness of a leopard. Alexander led his troops to Babylon, the Persian capital, where he ruthlessly avenged the Persian atrocities committed against the Greeks. And you know the stories of Alexander the Great. By his 30s, he'd conquered the known world. And ironically, he dies shortly after, and he dies in Babylon. And as the story goes, stories go, he wept because there was no more world for him to conquer. Dominion indeed had been given to him. And the influence of the Greek culture dominates Western thinking even until today. And some will note that upon his death, the Greek Empire was divided among his four generals, which may be why Daniel sees a four-headed beast. And Daniel, living in the 6th century, saw it all happen before Alexander was even born. Here then what we see are successive empires, the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, all called to the world stage by God. And then, and though Daniel knows far fewer of the specifics than we do, the message was the same. Here it comes again. Daniel, I'm aware of your situation. I am aware of what has been, what is, and what will come. And I set up one, and I put down another, and here come the next. But then comes the fourth beast, which gets all the attention in the chapter. Daniel has no animal with which to compare it. Maybe if he'd seen Napoleon Dynamite, he would have said, this is the ancient liger. This would have been it. It's more dreadful than all of the rest. And I think when we come to this fourth beast, here's what happens with the nature of prophetic imagery. The fourth beast, if I can put it this way, it looks like one beast, or it looks like one giant mountain peak from afar. But when you get up to it, you see that mountain peak spreads out into several others. That's what we're going to find when we look at this fourth beast. It is one, but when you get up to it, it's revealing a whole bunch of others the closer you get to it. So the empire that comes next in world history is that iron machine of Rome that's described that way in verses 7 and 8. This teeth of iron stomping on whatever in its path. And that's an apt description of the Roman Empire, whose violent Roman legions conquered with crushing force and crucified criminals. But Daniel sees that this beast has 10 horns and then an 11th horn, a little horn, that arises in verse 11 and destroys 3 of the horns. And then this little horn then is no longer a beast. For the first time, here's a horn, an animal that's not a beast. It has eyes like a son of man. And it's speaking great things. And we'll see in a moment the kinds of things that it does and says. At the same time, it's the most beastly of all the beasts described. And yet the most human-like of all. You might be forgiven for thinking that this is a human after all. This is a supernatural human. What does it all mean? Well, now we're in the same point with Daniel. Daniel's finally like, well, welcome to my world. It's nice for you to be able to say, oh yeah, couldn't you see? This is the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, and the Greeks, and the Romans. Well, now you're where I am. Welcome to my world. And now we're here where Daniel was. Nobody's quite sure what all of this means. And here's where all kinds of crazy speculation has come in, precisely because we don't know the end. But still, I think that even the New Testament and what's here, we can push a little more and try to think a little more while maintaining the overall points. So let's think about this. Here's what I think is happening. This is historical, but it's also very symbolic. So, for example, therefore, not every point needs to be pushed. And any of the beasts. So the horn of an animal is used in the Bible to symbolize strength. So think of the symbol for a moment of a Dodge Ram truck. What is it that's used to describe, you know, the pickup truck? It's the head of a ram with those powerful horns curved around, around, and again. Dodge uses the head of a ram with these curved horns to symbolize power and strength. Well, that's been an ancient symbol for a long time. The Bible uses the symbol of horns for strength. But now add 10 horns to one animal. What would that symbolize? It would be a way to present an image of unified but unsurpassed power. That's what I think is happening here. I think the number 10 is symbolic for the completeness of power, for the excellence of it all. The number 10 is already used. If you've been reading Daniel 1, the number 10 has already been used that way. They examined Daniel and his friends and they found them to be 10 times better than all of the others. That's an expression for completeness and unsurpassed excellence. So there are those who count, you know, the 10 toes in Daniel 2 and the 10 horns in Daniel 7, and they try to find 10 specific things. And, you know, there are 10 nations in the European Union. Now one's dropped out and 5 have been added. And are we there again? And what? When will this come? And maybe I got it wrong. And then one day will be the restored Holy Roman Empire, because this is the fourth kingdom. I'm thankful that somebody takes the Bible seriously to think about these things. And maybe that's where you are, and we can disagree and we'll meet in heaven sooner or later. But I think it's misguided. And I'm not trying at this point to be cute, because I think, again, the number of 10 appears to be symbolic. And with in the image itself, there's no hint of any kind of revival or restoration of an empire at all. There seems to be one that starts in a long continuation with catastrophic interruptions until the little horn comes at the end. So I think the 10 horns symbolize at the same time the unified power of Rome. And also, he does say later, the kinds of kingdoms that will come after. So rather than go Kingdom 1, Kingdom 2, Kingdom 3, Kingdom 4, Kingdom 5, Kingdom 6, Kingdom 7. Now he's shown us enough of an example. Here are all the ways that the nations of the world will rule. Here are all the ways that governments of the world are characterized. I'll end with Rome, and from Rome you can expect these kinds of governments to continue, especially after the image of Rome. So you have world history now. You have Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greek Empire, Rome, and then from Rome and the Ten Horns and beyond to all the kingdoms that come after. We could say in one sense, we're living, I think, in this time period of these ten kingdoms. And the last kingdom, Rome, is symbolic for our powers that will rise after it. And then finally we come to the little horn. Finally we come to the little horn. And the little horn is an 11th horn. Now look at how he's described. Verses 24 and 25 give us some of the description. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. And he shall be different from the former ones, and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and time and a half, or you could say for 3.5 years. This is a chilling description of the little horn. It's really what makes Daniel frightened. Just want us to notice what is said about this little horn. Verse 25. First, it will speak against the Most High. Here is an individual who had the audacity to make God his adversary. Not in an indirect way, but will publicly make himself an adversary against God. Second, here's the frightening part. This little horn will wear out the saints of the Most High God. Earlier we're told this little horn will make war against the saints of the Most High God. I think this is the most sobering part of the vision. For the last 3 weeks that I studied this, this is what's... I've just walked away from this text feeling like... Bleh. Because Daniel foresees a time for the people of God when they will face unimaginable suffering, pain, and death that will have been ordained by God. It's true that under Babylon, Christian faced the lion's den and fiery furnace. It's true that as early as the Persian Empire, we see Christians facing crucifixion. It's true that the Roman Empire threw Christians before gladiators and into the lions and colosseums for refusing to burn incense to the emperor. It's also true that many of our brothers and sisters today face beheading for being a Christian. And at some point in time, it may come our way. But chapter 7 is telling us this. It will get much, much worse than it's ever been. God is sovereign over our successes, but God doesn't always deliver His people from death. We have to stop thinking that if I die, I've been defeated and the game is over. That's not how God thinks. And this little horn tells us that one day, a little horn, a man, will arise and wear out and make accusations against God and make war against the saints to such an extent that the persecution of the past will seem trivial and light. No wonder Daniel is frightened by it all. He sees a fourth beast that apparently gives way to 10 other kingdoms, and then a little horn that unleashes the kind of suffering and destruction that reaches against the Most High God Himself. And Daniel sees a time when the enemies of God will have a great measure of outward success in killing His people. Isn't that what, if you were here during the prayer time, what Mike read to us last week? I mean, this isn't new in Christian revelation. Revelation 4, 5, and 6. Mike read for us that passage when the martyrs cry out to God, "How long, O Lord? How long? How long? How long?" And God says, "Put on a white robe, and I want you to rest. Some of your other brothers and sisters still need to be killed." That's the language of Revelation. And this is what Daniel sees. And what God is saying is, "I'm sovereign over your suffering, even when it leads to death." We're told further that this little horn, no doubt represented by individual historical figures. I mean, at one level, we all say, "Who's this little horn?" Some think it's Hitler. Look what he did, a crazed, crackpot Australian who rises to national prominence and systematically, in a cool way, wipes out 6 million people. Maybe that's it. Or there's Pol Pot in Cambodia who wipes out 2 million people. Maybe that's the one. Or then there's Stalin, 20 million people. Or then there's Mao in China, 40, 60 million people wiped out. Maybe it's him. All want to rewrite the calendar and rewrite history. Maybe it's him. Maybe it's him. Maybe it's him. Those in the first century thought it was Antiochus Epiphanes, who's a general who comes into the Jewish synagogue and slaughters a pig on the altar and then crucifies people who won't bow down and worship it. Maybe that's him. There is no doubt that people rise symbolically again and again. Here are these 10-horn kingdoms. Maybe one like the little horn. But now notice the last part of the verse. "They shall be given into his hand for time, times, and a half a time." Whatever the reference means, it's obviously highly prophetic and symbolic that appears again in Revelation and other passages. Whatever it means, it's saying this: they have a limited time. I have ordained the time when the suffering will end. As bad as it gets, I know exactly when it will end and when it's time to end. Power to this little horn. The power to those that kill the Lord's people. Oh, brothers and sisters, do you not hear our Lord Jesus Christ in the hour of his own death when Pilate boasted like the nations of this world who say, and Jesus, he says, "Don't you know I have the power to kill you?" And Jesus says, speaking respectfully, "Are you crazy? You would have no power at all except it were granted to you. And now power has been granted to the hour. And that will happen again. And death will come." Now, who is this little horn? I don't know the name. And if you know somebody who does, they don't know the name either. We're not there yet. I mean, maybe the person's alive. I don't know. But I do want you to listen to Paul, who uses the same description from Daniel 7, and he encourages New Testament congregations like ours, and he encourages them like this. And he begins in 2 Thessalonians 2, "Let no one deceive you in any way." There's the temptation. "For a day will not come," the end, "unless the rebellion comes first, a man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself against God and places himself in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God." The little horn in Daniel 7 is the man of lawlessness that Paul is still saying, "Don't be deceived. That will come before the end." And I think that "don't be deceived," you can take it a number of different ways. It's similar to Daniel's point. Don't be deceived. God really is in control. And don't go after false hopes and messiahs. Don't stop trusting in him. This is what must happen before he comes back. Don't be deceived, little ones. Don't be deceived. And I think all of this climaxes with that, what John sees in Revelation 13. I know it's long. We're at the end of the message. I want you to listen now how Revelation 13 basically feels like a copy and paste of Daniel 7. And listen how it's applied. "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea," Daniel 7, "with 10 horns," Daniel 7, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its head. And the beast that I saw, now you're going to get all of Daniel. I saw this beast that was like a leopard, and had feet like a bear, and a mouth like a lion, and they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is the beast and who can fight against it?" And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. That's Daniel's phrase of time, time, and time and a half. And it opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, even blaspheming those who dwell in heaven. And it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And every authority was given to it over every tribe and over every people and over every language and over every nation. Who is this little horn then? Well, we don't know his name. But it is the great Antichrist, who will arise under the sovereignty of God, who will arise to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And that Antichrist is just the fulfillment and climax of every government and every ruler that's cut God out of the picture and says, "I want to be God." So when you put all this together, God gives Daniel a vision that runs from Babylon to the Antichrist. And what's the point? There are lots of them. All of it happens in God's timing. You should expect to suffer, even greatly in this life. And when you do, remember, God's sovereign over your death. Now we have a more complete picture of what life in Babylon is like. We like to run to the deliverances from the lion's den and the fiery furnace, and we should pray for God to do that. But now we have a fuller, mature picture of what life can be like living as a citizen who won't withdraw, but who won't assimilate either. Be prepared that God will not always deliver His people. He's sovereign over our life, and He's sovereign over our death. And what we need is to take the prayer of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego on our lips and internalize it on our heart. We won't bow the knee before you, O King. God is able to deliver us. Daniel 1-6. But even if He doesn't, Daniel 7, we will trust God. And we're not quite done, because Daniel just doesn't see to the Antichrist. Daniel sees that in the end, God will ultimately deliver His people. He sees that God will win. The beginning of this chapter and the end, if you just look at it from a literary perspective, it begins with suffering and darkness and the beast advancing, and it ends with those interpretations. And right in the middle of the chapter, even from a literary perspective, right in the middle is God on the throne, and it's making that theological point. That in spite of what it looks like, God is always in the middle on His throne. Always. And like Belshazzar before Him, this little Antichrist will be mouthing boasts untrue. You know, he'll be partying like a rock star. And the very night, his life will be put out as easily as you blow out a candle before you go to bed. And the books will be opened, and the wicked will be judged. And then we'll see a fifth kingdom, a fifth column emerging. And here now is the Son of Man. And notice now, here is one who rules not as a beast. Here is one who rules as a man. And the Son of Man is none other than Jesus Christ that we looked at a few weeks ago. And He it is who will come. And He will come with clouds and give the kingdom to His people who have suffered. And He so identifies with our plight that He takes up our flesh and He becomes a Son of Man. And now, what you see in Daniel 7 happened to Jesus. They did speak against Him as the Son of God. They did make war against Him. They nailed Him to a cross, crucifying the Lord of glory. They wore Him out. That's the darkness of Daniel 7. And the world literally went black. But 3 days later. 3 days later, the Son of Man rose from the dead. That's the parting in Daniel 7. There he comes. Do you see him? There he comes. And he rose triumphant from the grave, and now all authority has been put into his hands. And we all, there will come Pol Pot, there will come Hitler, there will come Mao, there will come you, there will come me, standing before the Son of Man. Daniel says, prepare to face unimaginable suffering in this life, but it also says this, Jesus said this, don't you dare fear the one who has power to take your life. Fear the one who has power to cast you into hell. That's the message of Daniel 7. And let me give you like 6 things at the end. How do we put all this together? Brothers and sisters, you may have disagreed with some of my interpretation. That's really okay. You may agree and we both have gotten it wrong. That's even more okay. But I think these things, we all can agree. This chapter is written for Daniel and for people in his day and for us so that we might never be afraid. In this world, you will face tribulations. But take heart. I have overcome the world. Number 2, this chapter was written for Daniel and the people of his day, and it's written for us of our day, so that we would be faithful and trust the Lord even unto death. Trust Him, even if it costs you your life, because He's the one who's calling you home. Number 3, this chapter was written for Daniel and the people in his day, and it was written for us in our own day to remind us that God won't always deliver us. Number 4, this chapter reminds Daniel and us that the gospel advances through suffering. Daniel had this dream back then and saw all the suffering that would come, and there's suffering still to come. And thanks be to God, you and I are here because the gospel's not bound anytime. And never forget, brothers and sisters, that often that at the heart of the gospel message is the gospel wins through suffering. The cross, then the resurrection. That's why crucify yourself and die daily. What did you expect? The gospel advances through suffering. And never forget that those darkest times, they really are the times the gospel is about to break forth the most. J.R.R. Tolkien coined a phrase, a U catastrophe. We know what a catastrophe is, the U, that prefix of good, a good tragedy, a sudden turn in an event. And Tolkien describes 3 U catastrophes that you find in the gospel story. The first of the incarnation. Here's something good that happens, but immediately there's a turn, and there's the slaughter of the innocents, and the flight of his people, and the flight of the Holy Family into Egypt, and it looks like all is lost. And then God calls His Son out of Egypt back again. The second great eucatastrophe, of course, is the cross. You have to see Daniel 7 fulfilled at an initial stage at the cross. Don't you see that happening? The kingdoms of the world did their worst against Christ. They crucified Him. They beat Him. They killed the Son of God. But there was a sudden turn, and He rose from the dead. And then Tolkien says, in the Christian gospel, there's one to come. It's the second coming. When the little horn makes war against the saints of God, and He kills person after person and slaughters people. And when it looks the worst, here comes the Son of Man on clouds coming back, taking vengeance on those who don't know God. This chapter is written to remind us that every word of the Lord proves true. You can trust the Bible. And it's written so that we can trust the Lord Jesus Christ, who's the Son of Man, who gave His life as a ransom from our souls. And it's written to remind us we have a hope beyond the walls of this world. We await a new heaven and a new earth where every tear is removed. When Sam and Frodo are making their way up Mount Mordor, and all in the story, at every point, every character is pushed to the point of death. And here they are, heading towards Mordor, under the blackness of clouds. Sam has this feeling of hopelessness in his heart. And he looks up for a moment at the clouds, and for a moment, the blackness of the clouds parts, and what he sees is a star shining above the clouds. And he thinks, there is a light and goodness beyond the evil that I see. That is the middle of Daniel 7. Above, over all of the suffering of this world is the light of the glorious gospel and the Son of Man who's riding forth to conquer and to conquer. God is sovereign. Let us trust Him even to death.